Okay, so when we last left you, we were in the middle of the Tshuva of the Maharam Lublin. This was the late 16th century Tshuva that seemed not to have heard of what what Rosh Shlomo Luria claimed was the mainstream position. Rosh Shlomo Luria claimed the mainstream position would be always redeem captives above their value, and you know that Jews have always done that. And Rav Meir Lublin comes along and says, no posek has ever said that we redeem captives above their value. So we talked about how they seem to be living in parallel halachic universes, and I have no explanation for how it is they haven't heard of each other. Neither of them seem to have really good evidence about precedent or to like wildly reinterpret precedents in ways to allow space. What I said was we could create a policy ground for making both positions true, which is to say that the Marshal is talking about captives who are captured, Europeans who are captured by Barbary pirates. So if it turns out that it's unsustainable, you can always just stop and you lose a few people who are captured by pirates, but it's not a threat to your community. Whereas the Maharam Lublin is talking about a ruler of a country imprisoning somebody for the sake of the money, and that's a threat to your whole society, because if they choose to repeat that, then your whole society is at threat. So it's very reasonable to say that we redeem people above the market value when they're captured by outsiders, because if it turns out to be too many, we'll just stop. But you can't do that internally, because you can't just stop. If you stop, then they take all your money and throw you out, right? Once they have an appetite for your money. Right, so I thought that was a reasonable way of saying both positions could be true, but it's not an account of how both positions' account of the past tradition could be true, because they don't make any such arguments, right? They just each claim the other one doesn't exist. Yeah.
How strange is it that on a topic of such importance that there's such obscurity?
Really strange to me. They're really strange. Like people, you know, usually people have heard of each other. You know, there's these people living in the same halachic culture. You could imagine, you know, a universe in which Sephardim haven't heard of Ashkenazim, Ashkenazim haven't heard of Sephardim now. You could imagine a universe then in which, you know, people in certain parts of Europe haven't heard of people in other parts of Europe. But we're talking post-printing, right? We're already in the late 16th century. There's printing already. There's the Shulchan Aruch, which serves as a unifying text for everybody. Really hard to, and that, like it's the practice of a single community, mm-hmm. Right? So it can always be somebody's off oblivious, somebody has a sect. So you know, you can always try to come up with some kind of historical kimta to try and say how they could do it. But I am just puzzled. Mm-hmm. I don't have any explanation of how you could be. They're not ideological. You know, we could say like there are times when people in modern Orthodoxy haven't heard of anybody, haven't heard of anything said in the Haredi community, and people in the Haredi community may never heard of anything in the modern Orthodox community. There are issues in which you might miss each other, mm-hmm. but on an issue of communal policy like this, it could be, you know, the temptation is to say it must be ideological, and it must be they're refusing to recognize the other positions. But I don't see any reason they should say that. I don't have any. You know, say nowadays, right, you might find some people saying no posek has ever said that you should go to the draft in Israel. And other people saying, you know, every important posek has recognized that you have to go to the draft unless, right, you know, that you could imagine people doing that polemically, but it would have to be polemic. It has to be an ideological decision to disregard all the people who said otherwise. And I don't know anything like it. I don't know anything
it's
like
not
it.
Not like people acknowledge this is a difficult and potentially unresolvable issue. It just
I have no explanation. Yeah, I am hoping that somebody with more historically minded than I will listen to this and, you know, and tell me that when they were 5 years old, they got into a huge fight in the playground, and so they would never whatever it may be. You know, I'm just utterly baffled. Although again, the thing that should be said is that neither of them actually quote any literary precedent that's mm-hmm. that's on point. Right? They both make assertions mm-hmm. that this is what everyone does, this is what no one does. But they both make assertions. So it could be that you know that there is just a disconnect between popular practice and you know and some rabbinic figures who just had no idea mm-hmm. what people were doing. That could happen. But Maharam Lublin is you know is. In communal positions, he's not somebody sitting in an ivory tower. Mm-hmm. So how he could, something could have happened in the intervening 50 years. Maybe the Barbary pirates stopped and there were no Jews captured for those 50 years, and so he wouldn't know. I mean, all sorts of ways I could make stuff up, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. Okay, now we're going to get, so we have the Maram, so Maram Lublin, we know what he said, right? He said that that there's no, that nobody ever said that we redeem people above their market value. And he quotes the story, which, you know, his story is this one medieval tshuva where somebody refuses to pay back the money that was highly expensive. And he says, obviously, that wasn't the expectation if he refused to pay it back. On the other hand, there are places where they did spend money. So he ends up saying, well, you know, they spend money, but, you know, when it says lots of money, it means relatively lots of money because, right, because this is, because even buying slaves is more expensive than charity. Or right, you know, things like that. Nothing. He doesn't have a better answer. So now we're going to pick it up on I think on your sheets is page 12. The first words on the top of the page are the abbreviation Dalet Reish Lamed. Is that right on the top of page 12?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
Dalet Reish Lamed. Or is that page 13?
No, that's page 13.
Okay, so we're all, okay. So page 13.
Okay.
Page 13. Here we are. Right. So we're going to start on the fourth. On the fourth, I shall start on the second line. Here he says, from this medieval source, I'm quoting, it's not provable, shechayavim liftosan, even right, if we take it at face value, that it means lots, you spend lots of money, it doesn't mean you have to. Ela shekatav shirigilut liftosan b'takadol, he just says that people used to do it, right? So it could be, even when he becomes aware of practice, he just says, okay, what people do is not what they should do. Mm-hmm. Or even maybe they haven't allowed to. Alkein katafti mashner elani adati mitzad dina gemara v'poskims. I wrote what I think the halacha is. You don't redeem. Remember, it's a kid who's been accused of engaging in sexual activity with a Muslim woman, which for some reason seems to put him at risk of death. So I wrote that we don't redeem him above his market value, which I think is the dina gemara v'poskim. And now he says, Amnam, however, im takti sod ve'itza. But then I took counsel with a figure. I don't know anything about this figure, but that could be totally my ignorance. Rav Moshe Rabbi Yeshua. Lufi hanir'e, ein hatzar shove b'nizke hanar. So I'm not sure what that phrase means. Ein hatzar shove b'nizke hanar. It's a phrase taken from Megillat Esther. Ein hatzar shove b'nizke hamelech. And not entirely clear. It's we'll try and figure out going on exactly what he thinks. Like, you know, the damage to the kid is not what really is at stake here. Lo b'misaso v'lo b'kfiraso. Right, his death is not gonna solve anything, and his apostatizing is not gonna solve anything. V'lav dina kaboy, and for, right, and we're not talking. And this is not really a legal question. Actually, the woman was a loose woman, and the notion that this Jewish man has done something to corrupt this Muslim woman would make him liable for death. No, they made it up. She's a loose woman. He didn't do anything to her that hadn't already happened to her. That's the claim, right? He didn't assault her. It's all consensual, and it's not, right? It's not seduction if she, right? And again, there's a whole debate nowadays, right? But there, his claim is, right, this woman, you know, with loose sexual morals, his seduction didn't change her status at all in society. Ella, shenasan einav b'monmonchem bezrat Hashem. But your community, and he's writing to another community, not his own community. What's going on is your political leader has his eyes in your money. So even if you don't redeem the guy, right? He's going to find another way to get your money. So don't think you're saving anything by not redeeming him, right? You might think, you know, we don't want to redeem him because it'll get us trapped. You know, it'll associate us with this criminal. No, this has nothing to do with this person. It's just a trick. The Adaraba. And if you find a way to rescue him, you know, to free this nar so that the guy can't use him to tell on you, to you'll be even angrier at you. Right? You're just in bed with your leader, with your Gentile leader. I don't know what that is. Matzilat atzmam biyado, right? It thinks that lions and wolves get really, really angry when their prey get away. So don't think that getting this kid off is gonna solve anything. It's just gonna make things worse. And what happens if the child converts to Islam? So you might think, okay, that solves the young man. Converts to Islam, you think that solves our problem because now, right, there's no Jew who's a criminal. No, that's not right. Don't worry. Azaihu gamhu yabacharchem, then he'll be just drafted to blacken your names. Shatzar zayisitenu lotzi dibot ra'od v'alot shkarim umi yodeh heichan yagi advarim chatzushol. That the right, that your enemy is going to find a way to get him to make false accusations. So in the end, he says something very scary. He says, therefore, you're really smart people. Figure out what the best policy is, because halacha is not relevant. Because nothing you do is going to make it better. Redeem above value, you're just going to leave yourself open to more blackmail. Don't redeem him. All right, they're gonna find another way to get your money. If they force him to convert to Islam, they're gonna make false accusations against you. So you need to figure out what to do. And I don't know what it is that they tell him to do. That's just at the end. He says, like, you know, I don't have a good answer for you. I can tell you halakhically, you have no obligation to do it, but I can't tell you that that's the wisest thing to do because you're in trouble.
That seems very. Reminiscent of current reality.
Yeah, often. Often, you know, that the choices are not good choices. So Rav Avadia is gonna quote him as the opposition, right? Because he's the one person who says that you don't redeem cats above their value. But the truth is what he says in the end is, hey, this we can't force you to redeem. We don't have an obligation to redeem people above their value, but sometimes it might be the best thing to do. And sometimes it might not be the best thing to do and figure it out. Okay, that's Rav Meir Lublin. And if it's the only person in the tradition, right, if the Marshal and Rav Avadia are right, that he's really the only person who ever said that you shouldn't redeem cats above their value, it's not a very strong position. Because mm-hmm. He missed Tosfot. Yeah, so you know, it's reasonable to say that the Gemara seems to think that you don't have to, and the Marshal seems to think everyone did. And Rav Lublin thinks, okay, they did, but they didn't have to, but they decided it was wise, and so maybe that's still wise. Okay, so now let's go back to now we're on the next page. We're going to go through Rav Avadia's presentation of the Meiram Lublin. Okay, that's where on page 14 we're back in Rav Avadia's tshuva. All right, so Rav Avadia begins top of page 14. Vanochi haroeh. Bishut Maram Lublin, but I remember I've mentioned that Rav Avadia's introductions of sources are always introduced with visual terms. I see, because his vision was very poor, and I think he had a sense of humor. So he always, it's always some Hebrew Aramaic term for I saw. Unlikely, I think, to be coincidence. I don't know anyone else who does it as consistently. You know, people sometimes use those terms, but he's only those terms. Mm-hmm. Okay, and he quotes our tshuva, and he says right on the somebody who is captured by the Gentiles because there's a suspicion because they captured him with a Gentile zonah, however we translate zonah, and they want to execute him, and his answer was right. Sha'afel pi v'heshiv, sha'afel pi shepasha b'atzmo, mikol makom chayvim atzibur liftoso. Even though he caused his own right, he sinned against himself. He's responsible for his own situation. Nonetheless, people are obligated to. Feel obligated to redeem him, but skip down to the line beginning Ulam, right? It's like seven. Ulam nearly pashut she'ein mechuyavim liftoso yoser mechtei demav. But it seems obvious to me that there's no obligation to redeem him above his value. The mehechi tesi she'alei aladas liftoso right yoser mechtei demav. Where would you get the idea? Why is it different than any other stuff? Right? So he quotes. He quotes him absolutely straight, including the line, right? No posek has ever said it. And he says that, right, your only proof is this case of is the case of a man who sold himself into slavery or to cannibals. And all those stories say is that we do it, is that we, right, the most those stories tell us is that at risk of death, we redeem him even if he does it repeatedly. It doesn't say anything about redeeming him above his value. So. Right, so that's where the first section of the Maram is just quoted straight. There's no obligation to redeem above his value. Now you'll see this introduction says Vesefer Behil, In the Sefer Beit Hillel writes, now we know the right, in Yeridea, Kasav also, he wrote about this Maram Lublin. The Shemati B'Shem HaGaon Marin Rav Shmuel Kaidnuber, the author of a work called Tiferet Shmuel, who said, Sheneelam Einei HaMaram Lublin, Masha Kasav HaTosfot, She'im Yesh Sakanat Nefashot, Podim Oto Yoter Michtei Damav. He says the Marsh that the Maram Lublin just missed the key source. Right, we saw right several times right the way Rav Adya went through the logic, but Tosfos says very explicitly that you have to redeem that if somebody's at risk of death, you do redeem them above their value. Right? Tosfos is trying to reconcile the story of Rabbi Shua ben Hanani redeeming the captive child in Rome, and he gives at least two answers, and those two answers are one, he's at risk of death. So even though it didn't make any sense to us historically, Tosfos said it, and the Beit Hillel just says, look, I think the Maram missed the source. And if he missed the source, so then theoretically we could wipe him out of the process. Mm-hmm. We have a category called Tu'ebid Var Mishnah. Right? Tu'ebid Var Mishnah is somebody who misses a source that had they known it would have changed their decision. Mm-hmm. So he can, right now the thing is you can never know, they missed the source, right? So you can't know whether it would have changed their decision or not unless you point it out to them while they're still alive. And here we are much later. But so it's legitimate in halacha to say this source is so obvious that plainly it would have changed his mind had he known about it. Mm-hmm. So we could argue here, look, had the Maram Lublin known about Tosfot, and Tosfot is obviously a major source, all right, then he would never have said this. And on that ground, we can just wipe him out. Right? That the mechanism where the Gemara uses it is it allows you to reverse somebody else's decision in the same case. Mm-hmm. If you discover that the prior person, you know, the financial case, you discover that the previous award was made, yeah, was made on the basis of a missing a primary source that would have changed their mind, then you can reverse the decision and award the money to the other person without having to worry about the prior person's honor.
In practical terms, how high is that bar?
So that's a really good question. It's a really good question. Obviously, you know, it extends to some extent, but how much you respect the person in advance. Mm-hmm. Right? The more you respect the person in advance, the more likely you are to say, well, maybe he knew about it, I just didn't get it. And if you don't respect the person so much in advance, you'll say, oh, he just missed this one. Mm-hmm. And obviously, it depends also on how much you care. Mm-hmm. Yes, I don't know that that's a... Every legal system has abstractions. You talk, you know, on what grounds is it reversible? And then you figure out, you know, right now, it's probably the best analogy if you watch basketball. So you need clear and compelling evidence, I think, that the referee on the spot was wrong in order to reverse it. Right. So if the referee could, right, you could formulate that as if the referee looked at the same replay and wouldn't change the call, then you shouldn't change it either. But if you can say, look, I saw something on the replay, if the referee had seen it, they would have changed the call, then you change the call. Right? It's not a radical standard. You know, sometimes there's some other ideological positions, right? If we start pushing it, is like, say, you know, if I have a posting I like, but I know that you don't, and I'll say, but I know that, but you should change your mind if you don't. Then so I'll say, you would have changed your mind because you would have realized how important this was. It doesn't, you know, since it happens mostly in political context, it's hard to know. I'm doing a study now of the work called Shuvot Chavot Yair, and he's probably more willing to say it than most other people. He usually ends up saying it to the person, like, I think you just got this wrong. And the other person doesn't always react well. I have said it to friends about certain things that I feel strongly about, and they don't always react well. I imagine friends have said it to me also. I, of course, react spectacularly.
But there is a difference between saying you interpreted this wrong, your logic is wrong, as compared to saying you did not know that this other thing existed.
Yeah.
You hear stories in the paper about, you know, American trials where, you know, someone's been convicted of murder and 20 years later DNA evidence shows up.
Right. So that's factual evidence.
Right, so factual evidence that, well, just stick with that for a minute. But even then, we see here stories that courts are reluctant to overturn themselves.
Yeah, the Gemara frequently says things which, you know, which bother us a lot. But it says like that, you know, we can't, we got that wrong, but we can't change it because it would diminish the respect for the court system overall. Mm-hmm. And all that people have is the respect for the court system.
Mm-hmm.
And we can all pontificate and say, no, what makes people really respect the court system is admitting their mistakes. But not really. The NBA admits its mistakes after every game, you know, with its, you know, the 2-minute report, and it does not improve the respect for the referees. That may be because the referees don't admit their mistakes, the overall system admits the mistakes of the referees. Mm-hmm. So I'm not at all, sure. Yeah, I guess I may use it a little, you know, I think when you're confronted with what seems to be a ruling authority, so the only mechanism you have to evade that authority is to say, well, if they had known this, that would have been different. So, right? Mm-hmm. So, so this is, you know, I have argued on occasion, and this is not, you know, unique to me, that we have so much new material from the last 60 years
mm-hmm.
that, in essence, we have the capacity to destabilize halacha in a way that didn't really exist previously because we have so much more new evidence that we can use to claim that the people in the past would not have ruled this way had they seen this evidence. So we have, right? So in a sense, we have an opportunity to destabilize halacha, or we have a risk of destabilizing halacha
mm-hmm.
if we do this. So some people have tried to argue, right? Let's say there's a famous controversy about the positions of Rabbi Menachem HaMeiri. All right, so Rabbi Menachem HaMeiri, who lives in 13th century Provence,
mm-hmm.
So he's most famous for his positions that essentially eliminate all discrimination against Gentiles in non-religious matters. All the places where the Gemara has different outcomes for Gentiles and Jews, in financial issues, he just says it only applies to uncivilized Gentiles, and our Gentiles are civilized. Except for some people on island somewhere, right? He doesn't have to deal with it. So he says it all over his commentary. And that disturbed people because it seemed to people that it was against a lot of prior halacha. I argue it wasn't, but it mm-hmm. seemed to people that it's against a lot of prior halacha. So there are all sorts of fascinating mechanisms to resolve that. When I was in high school, we were told that the Meiri was discovered in the late 19th, early 20th century in the Vatican, which used to let one person in one day a year to look at Jewish manuscripts, and he had a photographic memory. And he would come out and write this down. So the only evidence we had of all these positions, which were very, very nice to Christians, was one manuscript in the Vatican, which we didn't even have access to see if, right? That was the story, but it's not true. It's not true at all. The manuscript's not in the Vatican. It's not only one manuscript in it. And much of it was published, before the 19th century. And elements of it are already published in the 16th century and known. It's really not a marginal figure at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting how the story develops. Because of Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef of Soloveitchik famously held that because the Meiri had not gone through the whole vetting process, right? So we viewed him as if he had been, so his status was not as a medieval, because what makes you medieval is that you've gone through 700 years of vetting. Because he was only late 19th century, so we treat him as having only the authority of late 19th century figures.
Mm-hmm.
And right, that's a very clever way out, but also not true, because in fact he was, right, you know, and we have discovered many other Rishonim since then whom we have not had anywhere near the same claim about that, even though they were less well known than the Meiris, right? The Chazon Ish has an article, the whole dispute about the Chazon Ish. I don't know if you were here when Gil Yehuda lived in Sharon, but but his father has a letter of, you know, about what the Chazon Ish really thought. You know, there's one place the Chazon Ish seems to say he refuses to learn it because, you know, it didn't go through the tradition, so it's not really other places where he uses it. And how you reconcile the formal statement, many articles about that, because people know, right, that if you allow radical positions that have, you know, that have left the mainstream to reemerge, so that can destabilize things. There are mechanisms for including it. You can say, you know, God obviously held these out of the tradition until the moment when they were necessary. And so it's only when we get to the Enlightenment era, and specifically the United States, that the Meiri appears exactly what we need to, you know, to produce a more liberal and accepting and accepting halacha, that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, the Rav's brother, ruled like the Meiri straight out. Right? So on these issues, Meiri is right. On that, again, there's different question of what the Meiri really meant and how radical that's a whole. I have a student, Professor Halpert, the whole issue about that. But he certainly said this about financial issues. Mm-hmm. And people try to say, okay, he says about financial issues, but he also seems to say to some extent about religious issues. It's a dangerous idea. And to some extent, if you're really happy with the way things are, so then you'll try and resist change, and you'll try and resist the capacity to say that. If you, if you think that the existence of a Jewish state required radical discontinuities in halakha from the right, you can't apply the halakha when you're a persecuted minority to a state where you're the powerful majority. So then you might very well look for resources and say, look, you know, and even though these resources are minority, but everyone would have recognized their truth had they had they known that. And I certainly do that on occasion. With awareness that it is highly destabilizing. Part of it is there. I just heard of Usher Weiss give a shir about this. He likes the Shulchan Aruch. Right? The Shulchan Aruch is this radical shift, right? Until the Shulchan Aruch, we don't really have codes. Mm-hmm. We had the Talmud, which is anything but a code. We had the Mishnah, which is not a successful code, if it was intended as a code. Right? We have a discursive tradition with lots of different positions, mm-hmm. And then and there were attempts. There were the Shulchan Aruch didn't come out of nowhere. Right? It's built on it, but there was no such the Rambam tried, the Rambam failed, except in most of the culture. Right? He succeeded in certain parts of the Sephardic universe in making his work a code. Mm-hmm. There's still people who treat him as a code, but I always love quoting that. Chabad teaches Rambam, and there was this fellow in Israel like, why do we teach Rambam? And the reason is because the Gemara says that you're supposed to teach halacha, but we also know that to learn lishma, you're not supposed to learn halacha. That's not right. That's not lishma anymore. That tells you what to do. So we learn halacha that we don't follow. And that's what the Rambam is. It's a wild way of making lemonade out of lemon. So the Shulchan Aruch was controversial at the time. There were people who resisted it. There are several famous critiques. My teacher, Michael Rosenzweig, has made some of those critiques famous. I had a tradition from the former rabbi of Israel of Brookline, who died last year, was moved to West Hempstead, Rabbi Kellmer. So Michael Rosenzweig said that to understand Rabbi Soloveitchik, you have to realize that the Shulchan Aruch never happened. It's just a book. It collects things, right? But it doesn't actually decide anything. Mm-hmm. All right. At most, what it does is you're allowed to rely on it until you've done the work. Mm. But when you do the work, you're not bound by its outcome. Mm-hmm. That's basically, if you want to understand Rishon LeZion, you have to understand that. So Rav Asher Weiss just gave a whole thing. No one should think that. Shulchan Aruch is binding, and we go. So that, so if you think that it's really important for the Shulchan Aruch to be binding, so then you're likely, you like stability a lot. Mm-hmm. You like codification. You're not likely to think that new sources should be able to uproot anything, at least, shouldn't let you go back to prior to the 16th century. And if you don't, right, if you think that was always a mistake, and everything should always be done straight from primary sources, then you'll be more willing to. So Ray Weiss said, right, that the figure who is described as undoing the Shulchan Aruch is the Vilna Gaon. Because the Vilna Gaon takes the Shulchan Aruch back to primary sources. Mm-hmm. But he said, no, what he does is he takes the Shulchan Aruch back to primary sources. He doesn't undo his decision. He just tells you what it really meant. And he undoes sometimes the post-Shulchan Aruch tradition. But he doesn't undo the Shulchan Aruch the way the tradition was that my tradition was that Rabbi Soloveitchik did. I think most of these issues, people have moods and tendencies. Much more than you have rigorous positions. There's always going to be a thing which pushes you to be, very few people follow their judicial policy absolutely. but there are people who are more originalists, right, in constitutional interpretation, and people who are less originalists. And originalists are more likely to be originalists than non originalists. But you're going to find Loris Tribe making original arguments on occasion. And certainly Professor Tribe says frequently that the alleged originalists are not being are not living up to their own constitutional things, and that it's not terribly surprising that law is a complicated endeavor, and people don't have it. I tend to think that I lean towards the position that if there is really good reason to argue that here is a source which they never saw, that creates an opportunity. Like that, if you feel that it would be better if there were change, that's a real opportunity. If you find a position they really never saw, but you have to be honest that that they really never saw it. Often you can do that dishonestly also and claim they never saw it, but of course they did.
Mm-hmm. A few minutes ago, you made a comment about how over the last 60 years, learned or discovered so much more that
manuscripts.
Massive
publication of manuscripts. Mm-hmm. Probably more medieval literature is available now probably than was available in the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. In any one place. I think that's probably simply true.
Mm-hmm. I imagine now it's not just it's uncovered, but it's available.
And also it's on databases.
Right.
It's not available to everyone. Has access to everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's the breadth of our bookshelf compared to 150 years ago is stunning, and even compared to the breadth of availability to people who people without photographic memories. Because they would be like, you had a photographic memory, you would wander through Europe, read the books, and write it. But how many people are there like that? Not very many people like that. And stuff comes in every day. My son was just complaining to me about that there are no reviews of critical editions. So you have no way of knowing whether something is good or bad, censored, distorted, things like that. That's true that there's not a real quality check.
Mm-hmm.
But we have so many commentaries that are now seen as central, at least in certain learning traditions. We have so many commentaries that are seen as central learning traditions that simply were utterly unavailable 60 years ago. I was learning with a student the other day, right? So you get stuck in a Tosfot. What do you do when you're stuck in a Tosfot? So when I was growing up, what you did when you're stuck in a Tosfot was there are two famous commentaries to resolve a Tosfot. There's the Maharsha, or Shlomo Edel, and there's Maharam Lublin, the same person we just read.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So two 16th, 17th century, maybe Maharsha may go into the 18th century, but I think it's like 17th century. And that's what there was. You're stuck in a Tosfot, you read those basic commentaries.
Mm-hmm.
When I was I think a freshman in college, I had a night seder, Chavruta, and I got stuck in a Tosfot, and I was dissatisfied with the answers given by the Maharsha and the Maharam. And I discovered there was one book of parallel Tosfot on Beta. And every time I looked at those, I go, oh my goodness, they solved the problem. I could just read the text. And I didn't have to resort to the forced answers the Maharsha and the Maharam gave.
Uh-huh.
I am Patak's The Chosen, right? That's how the hero presents his own reading of Gemara,
uh-huh,
based on manuscript. Whether that's true or not is a separate question. And I was like, oh my goodness, right? Like, the answers they're giving are based on a bad text. And we have, right, and there's better text now. Like, you have five different parallel Tosfot,
mm-hmm,
on those Masechta where you can compare. And then you have lots of other collections for the same period, and you read, and so most people in the modern Orthodox world, at least, their first reaction when you're stuck in a Tosfot is, let's find somebody else who has the same basic approach and see if this is resolvable textually.
Mm-hmm.
Not let's try and find somebody who will do their best to make the tortuous text we have work. That's just a radical shift, because
mm-hmm,
we have massive information available that the classic commentaries just didn't have. We have a revolution now in the study of the Jerusalem Talmud. My Jerusalem Talmud was fragmentary,
mm-hmm,
so far as we know. Like, not most of the classical Rishonim didn't have, or many of them did not have, a complete Talmud Yerushalmi, let alone one that was edited. There are no full commentaries by medieval figures on the Jerusalem Talmud. And then Israel happened, and all of a sudden you need agricultural laws. Agricultural laws are mostly found in the Jerusalem Talmud. There's this massive revolution. And then it turns out, like, we have like, you know, that there's lots of stuff from the same culture, from Palestinian halachic culture, and now you can start writing, and now we have databases, and so we can massively, so the commentaries you have prior to the 20th century are all basically reading the Yerushalmi, with the only other evidence they have available being the Bavli. Mm-hmm. And so some of them will read it, you know, Dafka against the Bavli, right? This is different. Some will read it, but the only background they have. Mm-hmm. And now we have a vast corpus of literature to compare it to, and it's a totally different thing. It's incredible we have an art scroll of Yerushalmi. I don't know what it does, but like, it's an incredible thing that, you know, like the text that was utterly unreadable, mm-hmm. now it has a popular English version, which may even be, I can't tell you if it's true or not. You know, I have tried to teach Yerushalmi and I collapse because I can't, mostly. And I gave a share, I remember, which people used to rotate one person coming every week because they thought I should give it, but I didn't think anyone should have to listen to it. And it was always like, every week I would prove how nobody, I say, I don't understand this, but I can prove to you that no one else has either of it. Mm-hmm. They have single lines, like where every commentary amended differently. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, so 8 commentaries, 8 different texts. And I think now it's like, you know, now there are commentaries that were not available then that are just game changing, just mm-hmm. utterly game changing because they have access mm-hmm. to things that nobody had before, and that's read differently. So, yeah. So, will that, you know, is the Yerushalmi playing a much bigger role in halakha than it did 60 years ago, even in areas other than agricultural? Absolutely. Because it's a coherent, it's a comprehensible text now, which it wasn't before. That's what I think. But you know, everyone, you know, I may, you know, I think probably I'm less radical about that than I was some years ago. I guess the more I learn, the more I think that it's more likely that I'm not learning the things I think are new or not actually as new as I thought they were. Yeah, I used to, because I didn't know them. So obviously no one else knew them either. And the more I know, mm-hmm. the more likely it is everyone else knew what I knew also. But I still think that it's probably right that that we should recognize that, you know, that theologically we should say, like, if things weren't accessible, they weren't accessible, and now they're accessible to us. They're accessible to us now. Mm-hmm. And so that's, right, so we should use what we have now. And if it turns out that God didn't make those accessible to people the last 500 years, it makes them accessible now. That's probably because they're useful now, mm-hmm. and right, in the way they would not have been useful 500 years ago. I don't have a difficulty with the radical way of framing it. Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, who is, have you heard of Kuttner? A wild late 20th century figure, mm-hmm. Happened to have been the teacher of one of my professors. Amazing philosophic thinker in homiletic terms, the work called Pachad Yitzchak. So he has an essay in which he says very strongly that if we found the Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote, you would not be allowed to use it halachically. Because it would not be the same as ours. There will have been, right, there are changes in terms of the orthography, at least, right? The Gemara admits that we don't have the orthography of Torah exactly, right? We don't know, right? It used to be that, you know, that certain vowels were spelled with vavs and olives and things like that. We don't have them anymore. And he says, like, you know, the halacha is that the Torah, he reframes, like, the one of the anima amins, right? The credo that we have. He says, mm-hmm. I affirm that the Torah which is in our day, the Torah which is in our hands today is the Torah which left the hands of Moshe Rabbeinu. It doesn't claim that it's identical with the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. Mm-hmm. It's the halachic embodiment of the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu, and uh-huh. and whatever changes happen, those are the changes that God wanted to happen. And this is our Torah, and our obligation is to affirm the Torah that's in our hands, in our day, mm-hmm. is the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu, and the Torah and objective evidence that it's not exactly the same as the scroll Moshe Rabbeinu wrote is irrelevant halachically. That's when people want to make this position most radically. That's what they quote. Mm-hmm. They quote a Kuttner saying that, you know, that it's even true of the text of Torah, that God, you know, the tradition is. The tradition is organized providentially.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can be very conservative and not be an originalist.
Yeah, there also, you know, there are ways to do.
Especially,
yeah,
if there have been long periods of stability.
Yeah, I don't know if that leads to conservatism. You know, Kuttner was certainly not a radical halachist.
But yeah, you know, here I'm using the word conservative just to mean.
You can be fundamentalist.
Slow to change, and.
You can be fundamentalist, and you can be fundamentalist and liberal. Like, right, this is a very, you know, that, in a certain way, right? There, there's no guarantee of how, you know, what how ideologies will relate to each other. Mm-hmm. And Rehuder, the space he was interested in was ideological creativity and not halakhic creativity. Mm-hmm. So he ends up, you know, so he says radical things like that, but has absolutely no interest that I know of in anything. I'm not aware of any radical halakhic position attached to him. Mm-hmm. But he was a wildly creative theological figure and an extremely effective pedagogue, very powerful figure with his students' lives. But other people are, you know, obviously the idea opens. He opened up space for people who wanted to use it to make halakhic arguments. You know, of course, then the question is, what if it only happens naturally? What would he have done if somebody had said to him, "Oh, so our tradition has the Meiri, right?" And you disagree with the Chazanish because you think our tradition has the Meiri, and that's what maybe would have bought it, maybe wouldn't. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would. I'm not an expert in this thought, I would be loath to make predictions about what he would think because he's a very, very complicated thinker, and I know very little. But it's fun. I can tell you, that. So that, you know, reading him is a joyous aesthetic experience often because the creativity is. And then there's the game of figuring out, like, because he read enormous amounts of secular material, but he never quotes it. So you know, there's a game of figuring out exactly, right? Exactly, how much of this did he know? And is he quoting it? Is he quoting it here without telling you? Because we know he read the stuff. Mm-hmm. We know he read the stuff. We know it both from him and we know it from his students because he happily talked to his students who were at university about all these things. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the Sefer Beit Hillel says that he heard from Shmuel Kaidnaber that we can just disregard this Maram. I think that's the implication, because Maram just missed the critical source. Mm-hmm. Okay, the Hosif, and he adds on. She'afalpi she'yesh lidchot rayat ha'tosot midin ha'mocher atzmo.
So he says, look, Tosas proves that you have to redeem someone from more than his value, because his claim is that if we redeem people who sell themselves, redeem the children who sell themselves, the children of people who sell themselves, that must mean we do it at more than their market value. And therefore, we redeem captives above their market value. And he says, that's not a good proof at all, because there we're not worried about the Gentiles capturing people so that we'll pay, right? People are selling themselves into slavery. So it's not going to have the implication, all right? You don't have the cover, right? You might worry that people in your own community will do it, but there again, if people in your own community do it, just stop. There's a limit, right? Because once you stop redeeming them, they'll stop selling themselves into slavery. Mm-hmm. So he might argue that Tosfos' proof is no good at all, because even if Tosfos is correct, that the Gemara says that we redeem people who sell themselves into slavery at more than the market value, so what? Redeeming people who sell themselves into slavery is not the same thing as redeeming people who are captured by others, because it doesn't have the same policy risk. Right? So, right? He says even though the Maram forgot Tosfos, but Tosfos is not compelling. But then he says, Avala emes kedivrei Tosfos. But even though Tosfos' evidence is uncompelling, Tosfos is right. The truth is with Tosfos. Shem ratzu lehargo. That if there's a that if they want to kill him, you have to redeem him with all the money that's available. Why? Because the Rambam wrote, somebody who averts their eyes from redeeming captives, don't harden your heart against the poor, and don't like close your hands against them, and against the prohibition against standing idly by while your neighbor is dead. Okay, we'll leave that one aside for now. It's about slavery. Right, so the Hill says, I can flip what you're saying. You think that you're engaged in the positive mitzvah of pidyon shvuim. You're not. You're engaged in avoiding the standing idly by your neighbor's blood. And now he takes a formal principle. Formal principle is that for positive mitzvot, you only have to spend 1/5 of your money. But for negative mitzvot, you have to spend all your money rather than violate something. So therefore, if we define pidyon shvuim as a negative mitzvah, we say that by inactivity, you violate a prohibition, right? There's a prohibition to be inactive. Do not stand idly by your neighbor's blood. And if we say that there's a formal principle, anything that commandment which is formulated as a prohibition, one has to spend all one's money to avoid violating. So it turns out that there's obviously a mitzvah to spend all your money to redeem captives. Okay. Right. So now, right. So now it's just right. That's just, all your money is mortgage. So now you get. Today can tell you. Hang on a second. But that doesn't make any sense. Now Rav Avadia says this doesn't make any sense at all, because we know that the Mishnah says you're not supposed to redeem captives more than their market value. So what is the Beit Hillel doing, saying that it's obvious you have to redeem captives above their market value because it's a mitzvah lo ta'aseh, when we know that there has to be some case in the Gemara, based on the Mishnah, where we tell people not to. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let's watch what he says. He says, the lichor advar of tumim. What he says seems to be astonishing. Right, he brings a proof from the Rambam who's talking about generic redemption of captives. But nonetheless, despite that Rambam, you know, before that Rambam, right, we learn and we accept. So the Beit Hillel's argument can't be right, because if he were right, then the rabbis could never have decreed this, that you can't redeem captives above their value. So the only solution is casuistic. So you have to say that his answer is that with a regular captive, a stam shavui, yesh koach b'yad chachamim lakor divrei Torah b'sheva al ta'aseh mishum takanat ha'olam. Right, that when it comes to ordinary captives, the rabbis had the power, as they do, right? The rabbis have the power to suspend, to tell you to violate the Torah, as long as they tell you passively. Okay, so let's set up the conceptual problem we have here, is that there are positive and negative commandments, mm-hmm. and there's action and inaction, and they don't match each other. There are positive commandments that require inaction, and there are negative commandments that require action. Right, because it just depends on the formulation. Mm-hmm. Right, if I say "don't stand idly by,"
that requires action.
That requires commandment. Right, if I say "be very careful," that requires inaction. Be very cautious. Okay, so one of the generic debates which you can always put together a 2-hour shiur on, wherever you want, whatever you need to, is how do we handle the interrelationship of these categories, because people are always confusing them and conflating them. Mm-hmm. Easy way to illustrate is that if you keep wearing a shatnez garment, you are actively violating the prohibition against wearing shatnez. Mm-hmm. But if you keep wearing a four-cornered garment that has no tzitzit, you are just failing to fulfill the mitzvah of putting on tzitzit. So you have the same garment, mm-hmm. right? Leaving it on violates one active prohibition and one, right? Mm-hmm. And right, in other words, just a failure to fulfill a positive prohibition. Same, even though in each case you're just standing still, nothing's changed. Okay, so the question, when we say that you have an obligation to surrender all your money rather than violate a negative prohibition, as opposed to only a fifth for a positive prohibition, assuming these are absolute rules, which is not probably true, but let's assume they are. So the question is that really a distinction being made between positive and negative prohibitions, or is a distinction being made between actions and inaction? That you have to actively spend a fifth of your money, right? But then you can stop and not do what you have to do, but in order to avoid doing something wrong, you have to spend all your money. Or is it, that's not how it's framed. So the question whether you violated an essay or you violated all the essay. So the Beit Hillel says that we'll take the claim you have to spend all your money as organized around the formula, the nature of the prohibition. Is it a don't or a do? And not around inaction versus action. And therefore, failure to redeem a captive is a violation of a do not, and therefore you have to spend all your money not to avoid doing it.
Do not stand idly by.
Right. So that's how. So now he says there is a principle that the rabbis have the right to tell you to be inactive. even if by doing so you will fail to fulfill an obligation. For example, the rabbis tell you not to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah when it comes out on Shabbos. Okay, so now does that extend to telling you to stand idly by someone's blood? Again, right. So we say the rabbis can tell you not to fulfill a positive commandment. Mm-hmm. Right? They can tell you not to blow shofar. Mm-hmm. Can they also tell you to not avoid violating a prohibition as long as they're doing the way they do that is by telling you to be passive? Mm-hmm. So the rabbis tell you don't redeem that captive. So they're right in that case, they're not telling you to fail to fulfill a positive mitzvah like shofar, they're telling you to violate a prohibition against standing idly by. Mm-hmm. But they're also telling you just to be passive. So does the rabbinic power to tell you to not fulfill a mitzvah aseh, is it because it's a mitzvah aseh, a positive commandment, or is it because the rabbis can always tell you to stand still? Mm-hmm. So his assumption is the rabbis can always tell you to stand still. And therefore, even though in this case, standing still, not spending the money, is a violation of a negative prohibition, the rabbi can still tell you to do that. Okay, so that's how, even though the Rambam says that this is a negative prohibition, don't stand idly by your neighbor's blood, the rabbi can tell you, yes, stand idly by your neighbor's blood. But it means that we're living in the tension between a negative prohibition and a rabbinic decree. Mm-hmm. Right? Because really, I want desperately to free these captives because otherwise I'm violating this terrible prohibition. So what he says is, therefore, if there's any doubt as to whether the rabbinic decree applies to this prohibition, of course you're going to do it, because the risk of violating the prohibition is so great that if there's a doubt whether you're violating or not, you're going to do it. It's only if the rabbis tell you unequivocally that you're not supposed to do this that you'll listen. So now he says, so therefore, as long as anybody has a plausible argument that you have to redeem captives above their value if their life is threatened, that argument is going to win. Because once we've raised the stakes to being a prohibition, mm-hmm. and now once there's a plausible argument, so the risk is too great. So I'm going to resolve the doubt in favor of redeeming the captives. So therefore he says, since we don't know whether or not the rabbi has extended the decree against overpaying for captives to captives whose lives are threatened, so therefore we have to redeem it anyway, even though there's a plausible argument, even though Tosfos has no proof for his position that the decree doesn't apply, but the burden of proof goes the other way. It's not that the default is that the decree is absolute, the rabbinic decree is absolute, and you have to prove that there's still an obligation to redeem captives. It's the other way around. There's a Torah prohibition against not redeeming them. And you have to prove that the rabbinic license extends that way. Mm-hmm. So by reversing the burden of proof, he ends up with the outcome that we have to redeem captives whose lives are threatened at any price. And that just feels, I think that's what I tried to teach students in the summer. Like, is that the most important debate move you can make in halacha is to shift the burden of proof. Mm. And much of halacha, most of the arguments are not about who has better evidence, but who has the burden of proof. Mm-hmm. And so that's what he did here. He shifted the burden of proof. And by shifting the burden of proof, he made the weakness of his argument irrelevant.
Going back a few weeks.
Yeah.
And we danced around the question of what might the market price be defined as.
Yeah.
So all these discussions are using that terminology.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't know how different the discussion would be if we asked the question, should you pay fair market price to redeem?
Yeah, so so the Maram Lublin suggested that, right, he held that market price just meant slave market price, which is, you know, unknowable now, which is a real problem. But you know, what would happen if market price for captives were, right, were, you know, the market price for a captive in the general world were six seras, I think that the halachic default would shift dramatically. It'd be obvious that the halachic default would be to redeem the captives, and you'd have to argue against it. Whereas if you think that you're overpaying, then then usually the halachic default shifts. You have to justify the overpayment. But we're going to see, right? You know, that in the course of argument, right? So Rav Avadia has just found Rav Avadia's explanation of the Beit Hillel gives you a way of shifting the argument. They'll say, no, right? There's always a biblical obligation to redeem captives, which entails all your money, and the burden of proof is on you. So that's going to be the move that everyone is going to try to make who's in favor of paying any price, is to try and shift the default in that direction, right? So I always find people quoting, like, Pidyon Shvuim is the greatest mitzvah. All right, it's the greatest mitzvah, then why did the rabbis tell you not to do it? Right? So it's obviously not, you know, that's why I pointed out to you at the beginning, it's not the greatest mitzvah, it's just a really important thing to do, right, to use communal charity funds for. We could also, by the way, point out that the claim that you have to use all your resources to avoid violating a negative prohibition may not apply to communities.
Right.
May only apply to individuals. And if that's the case, then the argument doesn't get started. Right? That's the fast one of what he's pulling by seemingly assuming that communities also have the obligation to spend all their money on to avoid the negative prohibition of standing idly by your neighbor's blood. But maybe communities aren't bound by mitzvot in the same way that what Rav Tendler argued, and I think is right, that I generally think things are more sliding scale than hard switch. And you know, I generally prefer analog to digital switches when thinking about law. But one of the ways of framing the difference between communal decision making and individual decision making halachically is that individual decision making only relates to people who are currently alive. Mm-hmm. Whereas, right, real people are currently alive, whereas communal decision making relates to statistical people. And you can say the community can't do this because it will lead to the deaths of people who are not yet born. Mm-hmm. Even the right community, and the community has to make a choice, right? It has to have people undergo risks now for the sake of people who are not yet born but who will be at risk. Individuals can't make that, right? Individuals very likely most of the time should not be thinking that way. Their responsibility is just to whoever's alive, and you don't, you know, as a community, you don't think, well, if I save this person in 20, right, in 20 years, that's going to set a precedent, you know, that will end up to the death of two more people. Mm-hmm. Or whatever the argument may be, you know, whatever kind of framework you're talking about, communities can. Right? Communities can say,
wait a minute, we do that all the time.
As communities.
Definitely as communities.
As individuals?
I mean, we're always making decisions that with the knowledge of, or the expectation of what the downstream, even multi-generational downstream impact will be.
So I think it makes this, but let's say you have a duty to a person in front of you. Mm-hmm. You don't usually think as an individual. Well, what will be the sociological? You shouldn't generally think. What would be the broader sociological consequences of my fulfillment of my duty to this individual? Mm-hmm. You do have a duty to the individual. All right, you do it. Whereas the community is entitled to think that if I spend, you know, if I give my charity, if I give all our charity to the poor people now, we won't have enough money to pay for healthcare. We'll have less healthcare in 10 years. We're going to invest in healthcare because if we put the money in a hospital now, right, as opposed to in charity, right? So we'll be able to save, right? We'll be able to save, you know, to save neonates in 10 years, right? That's not a individual people, right? You have a responsibility to keep the people who are alive now. And who knows what's going to happen? I think that I think that there are times when the community can dictate the actions of individuals. And that's often, I think, is relevant in terms of triage. As an individual, right? If you have a person in front of you who, right, let's say, right? First, you know, these hypothetical situations, right? But you have a person in front of you who needs a dose of an anti-serum that would be enough to save two more people. Mm-hmm. And it's likely that two more people will show up before you can produce more anti-serum. As an individual, you have a person in front of you, you got to save them. Mm-hmm. As a hospital, you might very well set policy that as a healthcare industry, you might ration it. Mm-hmm. As a person working in the hospital, I might be entitled or obligated to follow the hospital policy, as opposed to what my duty would be as an individual. Mm-hmm. And so I talked about that during COVID with respirators. That, right, that it might be that on the one hand, if it were your respirator, right, this is what you would have to do, or you have to treat the patient as it comes in. But if you're, but if it's not your respirator, it's the hospital's respirator, so now the hospital gets to make decisions differently than you do. Mm-hmm. And once the hospital made its decision, now you are bound and entitled, you're entitled and bound to follow the hospital policy, even though that means that you're not fulfilling your individual responsibility. Right? Not everybody agreed with me on that, but I think that I think that was probably true. But, you know, people have other mechanisms for trying to solve those sorts of the problems that were that it led to the other way. But I think that's probably the right way to do it, is to claim that when you're part of a system that is legitimately thinking on a communal level, then so long as the system is moral, right, you're entitled to act as part of the system as opposed to imposing your individual obligation on the system.
I mean, if you get drafted into Tzahal,
yeah,
Gaza, and put your life at risk, with the idea being that this will help the next generation of Israelis.
Yeah, so can you put your life? We're going to talk about, you know, what, on what grounds can you risk the current? Can you risk the, right? So a state can risk the army, mm-hmm, for the unborn, but it's not clear that an individual is entitled to, right, to commit suicide for the sake of people, you know, or to even to put their lives at risk for the sake of people not yet born. Mm-hmm. As it's not clear that that we would allow people to engage. Certainly, we wouldn't obligate people to engage in medical trials, mm-hmm, that will only benefit people, you know, in 70 years. Mm-hmm. Even as a risk to them, but we can obligate them to go to the army, but we probably couldn't obligate them to participate in medical trials but we might allow the government to, right, to draft people for medical trials the same way it drafts people for the army. Right, that would be the kind of thing of doing that. It's, mm-hmm, I'm trying to think harder about how it started this when we did Lashon Hara in journalism in SPM some 7, 8, 9 years ago. And now everybody's earnings book is now out. First started off that summer, his book on social media. But one of the things that in preparing for that, I ran across a tshuva of the Tzitz Eliezer, who wanted to know, why is it that secretaries can have access to medical records? Assuming that medical records are information that people are entitled to keep private, and it's a harm to share medical information with people who have no medical necessity, mm-hmm, to know it. So secretaries have no medical necessity to know, right, to know the information. So why are secretaries allowed to look at medical records? And his answer was, secretaries are not people for these purposes. Secretaries are elements of the hospital. The hospital has to have access to your medical records.
Right, they're part of,
right, the system has to keep going, right? So so if they ask, people ask me outside my job, am I allowed to look at this? The answer would be no. Well, what gives you the right to look at this person's information? Of course not. And of course, we'll say that you're not allowed to know it outside, right, your job. You're only allowed to know it in the context of your job. Anybody asks you afterwards, right? The fact that I saw your medical records, right, you know, when I'm working as secretary, I can't tell anybody about that. But within the hospital, I don't have to engage in efforts to minimize the number of people who look at the records. I can engage in a practice that enables the hospital to run as efficiently as possible. Even though it might be like a cumbersome system where doctors had to hand copy everything in, right, and code it, and secretaries only dealt with it anonymously. So you don't have to, maybe in some cases that will be wise, but you don't have to do that because the hospital is allowed to think of itself as a hospital. Mm-hmm. So that was like, that opened up a whole space for me, which, you know, I'm resistant on the one hand because I like autonomy, and on the other hand, it seems to be true that there's some ways in which we have to think systemically, and people are allowed to do things in the context of a system that they would not be allowed to do as private figure people.
So, in this example, where I was going to say, you have to assume that for the hospital to work, the secretary needs have access to that information. So let's say that's not the case. So does that mean that the guy sweeping the floor at night also gets access?
Yeah, so I think we have to, you know, I think that is very complicated to say exactly how we set it out. I think the answer would be that the hospital has to have a plausible reason, but I don't know that the hospital has to engage in an effort to make sure that it has minimized the number of, right, that has built a system which minimizes the number of people who need to see it. Mm-hmm. It needs to make sure that only people who need to see it in the context of its system see it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't need to set up a system which minimizes the number of people who see my medical records. Maybe it would be wise. Mm-hmm. If we discovered there were many scandals, right, and people were selling people's medical records, then we would set it up. But prima facie, if we set up a system which has 10 secretaries which see my medical records as opposed to 5, mm-hmm. and I do it, but that way the records get encoded, you know, a little bit more cheaply. Mm-hmm. Right, because that way, because I have each person focusing on their particular box, and that they look at 10 people as opposed to having one person go across 10 boxes, which is less efficient typing information. I mean, again, just totally hypothetically. So that's okay. The hospital runs more efficiently if 10 people get to see it. Okay.
I guess I was getting too much Norwegian in this particular story, but one would also want to. If within a system you allow certain things, don't allow without it.
Yes, you have to have proper precautions.
You want to some sort of expectation that there's a wall between two worlds. And even when this secretary or this doctor, or whoever,
yes, we have laws about that.
Walks out the door,
we have laws about that. And we might very well change the duty if it turned out those laws were ineffective. But the secretary, again, if the secretary is part of a moral system, mm-hmm. the secretary doesn't have to ask him or herself every moment, am I allowed to look at this? Mm-hmm. No, whatever the system tells you you're supposed to look at, you look at. Because you're doing your job, and we presume that your job is part of a moral system. You know, if you have a job which is inherently immoral, right, that's the whole, you know, what if you're a journalist for a paper that just prints gossip? Right, that was what we spoke about that summer. To what extent is journalism the kind of profession where you can basically accept the ethics of the profession and assume that you're working in a system which does which mm-hmm. yields desirable goals? And right, if you're working for a celebrity magazine, no, right? The goals themselves are not desirable goals mm-hmm. From a halachic perspective. So then, no, you can't do that. There's no positive aim that the organization as a whole is accomplishing. I mean, maybe, you know, that's maybe my bias, right? Mm-hmm. There's a whole, you know, the case that I dealt with years ago about, you know, the legitimacy of being celebrity journalists is still, mm-hmm. I think about a lot. As opposed to, you know, investigative journalism, which I think is generally a big mitzvah. Somebody has to do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then you tell us your editor, and the editor's allowed to read it the editor doesn't have to say, well, am I allowed to read this? Because it might be Lashon Hara, maybe I'm not one of the people who has to read it. No, the editor has to be edited, so the editor has a job, and the editor doesn't like that job, then the editor can do something else. But it's not a violation of the editor's duty to look away from Lashon Hara to edit their copy of a reporter. Mm-hmm. That at least is my claim. All right. Thank you as always.